Sheriff William Hamley rode through Newport and crossed the stone bridge that led into what was now called the Old Town of Kingsbridge. Today the newly completed Kingsbridge Cathedral would be consecrated. He passed through the formidable city gate and went up the main street, which had recently been paved. The dwellings on either side were all stone houses with shops in the undercrofts and living quarters above. Kingsbridge was bigger, busier, and wealthier than Shiring had ever been, William thought bitterly. He reached the top of the street and turned into the Priory Close, and there before his eyes was the reason for the rise of Kingsbridge and the decline of Shiring. The cathedral. It was breathtaking. The immensely tall nave was supported by a row of graceful flying buttresses. The west end had three huge porticos like giants' doorways, and rows of tall, slender pointed windows above, flanked by slim towers. The concept had been heralded in the transepts, finished 18 years ago, but this was the astonishing consummation of the idea. There had never been a building like this anywhere in England. The market still took place here every Sunday, and the green in front of the church door was packed with stalls. William dismounted and left Walter to take care of the horses. He limped across the green to the church. He was 54 years old and heavy, and he suffered constant pain from gout in his legs and feet. Because of the pain, he was more or less permanently angry. The church was even more impressive inside. The nave followed the style of the transepts, but the master builder had refined his design, making the columns even more slender and the windows larger. But there was yet another innovation. William had heard people talk of the coloured glass made by craftsman Jack Jackson had brought over from Paris. He had wondered why there was such a fuss about it, for he imagined that a coloured window would be just like a tapestry or a painting. Now he saw what they meant. The light from outside shone through the coloured glass, making it glow, and the effect was quite magical. The church was full of people craning their necks to stare up at the windows. The pictures showed Bible stories, heaven and hell, saints and prophets, disciples, and some of the Kingsbridge citizens who had presumably paid for the windows in which they appeared, a baker carrying his tray of loaves, a tanner and his hides, a mason with his compasses and level. I bet Philip made a fat profit out of those windows, William thought sourly. The church was packed for the Easter service. The market was spreading into the interior of the building, as always happened, and walking up the nave, William was offered cold beer, hot gingerbread, and a quick fuck up against the wall for threepence. The clergy were forever trying to ban peddlers from churches, but it was an impossible task. William exchanged greetings with the more important citizens of the county. But despite the social and commercial distractions, William found his eye and his thoughts constantly drawn upward by the sweeping lines of the arcade. The arches and the windows, the piers and their clustered shafts, and the ribs and segments of the vaulted ceiling all seemed to point toward heaven in an inescapable reminder of what the building was for. The floor was paved, the pillars were painted, and every window was glazed. Kingsbridge and its priory were rich, and the cathedral proclaimed their prosperity. In the small chapels of the transepts were gold candlesticks and jewelled crosses. The citizens also displayed their wealth, with richly coloured tunics, silver brooches and buckles and gold rings. His eye fell on Aliena. As always, his heart missed a beat. She was as beautiful as ever, although she had to be over 50 years old now. She still had a mass of curly hair, but it was cut shorter and seemed to be a lighter shade of brown, as if it had faded a little. She had attractive crinkles at the corners of her eyes. She was a little wider than she used to be, but she was no less desirable. She wore a blue cloak with a red silk lining and red leather shoes. There was a deferential crowd around her. Although she was not even a countess, merely the sister of an earl, her brother had settled in the Holy Land, and everyone treated her as the earl. She carried herself like a queen. The sight of her brewed hatred like bile in William's belly. He had ruined her father, raped her, taken her castle, burned her wool, and exiled her brother. But every time he thought he had crushed her, she came back again, rising from defeat to new heights of power and wealth. Now William was aging and gouty and fat, and he realized that he had spent his life in the power of a terrible enchantment. Beside her was a tall red-haired man, whom William at first took for Jack. However, on closer examination, the man was obviously too young, and William realized it must be the son of Jack. The boy was dressed as a knight and carried a sword. Jack himself stood next to his son, an inch or two shorter, his red hair receding at the temples. He was younger than Aliena, of course, by about 5 years, if William's memory was right, but he, too, had lines around his eyes. He was talking animatedly to a young woman who was surely his daughter. She resembled Aliena, and was just as pretty, but her abundant hair was pulled severely back and plaited, and she was quite plainly dressed. If there was a voluptuous body under that earth-brown tunic, she did not want anyone to know it. Resentment burned in his stomach as he regarded Aliena's prosperous, dignified, happy family. Everything they had should have been his, but he had not given up the hope of revenge. The voices of several hundred monks were raised in song, drowning the conversations and the cries of the hawkers, and Prior Philip entered the church at the head of a procession. There never used to be this many monks, William thought. The priory had grown along with the town. Philip, now over 60 years old, was almost completely bald and rather stout, so that his formerly thin face had become quite round. Not surprisingly, he looked pleased with himself. The dedication of this cathedral was the aim he had conceived when he first came to Kingsbridge, 34 years ago. There was a murmur of comment when Bishop Walleran came in, clad in his most gorgeous robes. His pale, angular face was frozen in a stiffly neutral expression, but William knew he was seething inside. This cathedral was the triumphant symbol of Philip's victory over Walleran. William hated Philip, too, but all the same, he secretly enjoyed seeing the supercilious Bishop Walleran humbled for a change. Walleran was rarely seen here. A new church had finally been built in Shiring, with a special chapel dedicated to the memory of William's mother, and although it was nowhere near as large or as impressive as this cathedral, nevertheless Walleran had made the Shiring church his headquarters. However, Kingsbridge was still the cathedral church, despite all Walleran's efforts. In a war that had raged over 3 decades, Walleran had done everything he could to destroy Philip, but in the end Philip had triumphed. They were a bit like William and Aliena. In both cases weakness and scruples had defeated strength and ruthlessness. William felt he would never understand it. The bishop had been obliged to come here today for the dedication ceremony. It would have looked very peculiar if he had not been here to welcome all the celebrity guests. Several bishops from neighboring dioceses were here, as well as a number of distinguished abbots and priors. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Becket, would not be here. He was in the throes of a quarrel with his old friend, King Henry, a quarrel so bitter and fierce that the Archbishop had been forced to flee the country and had taken refuge in France. They were in conflict over a whole list of legal issues, but the heart of the dispute was simple. Could the king do as he pleased, or was he constrained? It was the dispute William himself had had with Prior Philip. William took the view that the earl could do anything. That was what it meant to be earl. Henry felt the same about kingship. Prior Philip and Thomas Becket were both bent on restricting the power of rulers. Bishop Walleran was a clergyman who sided with the rulers. For him, power was meant to be used. The defeats of 3 decades had not shaken his belief that he was the instrument of God's will, nor his ruthless determination to do his holy duty. William felt sure that even while he conducted the consecration service for Kingsbridge Cathedral, he was casting about for some way to spoil Philip's moment of glory. William moved about throughout the service. Standing was worse for his legs than walking. When he went to Shiring Church, Walter carried a chair for him. Then he could doze off for a while. Here, though, there were people to talk to, and much of the congregation used the time to conduct business. William went around ingratiating himself with the powerful, intimidating the weak, and gathering information on all and sundry. He no longer struck terror into the hearts of the population, as he had in the good old days, but as sheriff he was still feared and deferred to. The service went on interminably. There was a long interval during which the monks went around the outside of the church, sprinkling the walls with holy water. Near the end, Prior Philip announced the appointment of a new sub-prior. It was to be Brother Jonathan, the priory orphan. Jonathan, now in his middle 30s and unusually tall, reminded William of old Tom Builder. He, too, had been something of a giant. When the service finally ended, the distinguished guests lingered in the south transept, and the minor gentry of the county crowded around to meet them. William limped over to join them. Once upon a time he had treated bishops as his equals, but now he had to bow and scrape with the knights and small landowners. Bishop Walleran drew William aside and said, "Who is that new sub-prior?" "The priory orphan," William replied. "He's always been a favourite of Philip's."
"He seems young to be made sub-prior."
"He's older than Philip was when Philip became prior."
Walleran looked thoughtful.
"The priory orphan. Remind me of the details."
"When Philip came here, he brought a baby with him."
Walleran's face cleared as he remembered.
"By the cross, yes. I'd forgotten Philip's baby. How could I have let something like that slip my mind?"
"It is 30 years, and who cares?"
Walleran gave William the scornful look that William hated so much. The look that said, "You dumb ox, can't you figure out something that simple?"
Pain stabbed his foot, and he shifted his weight in a vain attempt to ease it.
Walleran said, "Well, where did the baby come from?"
William swallowed his resentment. "It was found abandoned near his old cell in the forest, if I remember rightly."
"Better and better,"
Walleran said eagerly. William still did not see what he was getting at.
"So what?" he said sullenly.
"Would you say that Philip has brought the child up as if it was his own son?"
"Yes."
"And now he's made him sub-prior?"
"He was elected by the monks, presumably. I believe he's very popular."
"Anyone who is sub-prior at 35 must be in line for the post of prior eventually."
William was not going to say "so what" again, so he just waited, feeling like a stupid schoolboy, for Walleran to explain. At last Walleran said,
"Jonathan is obviously Philip's own child."
William burst out laughing. He had been expecting a profound thought, and Walleran had come up with a notion that was totally ludicrous. To William's satisfaction, his scorn brought a slight flush to Walleran's waxy complexion. William said, "No one who knows Philip would believe such a thing. He was born a dried-up old stick. The idea!" He laughed again. Walleran might think he was ever so clever, but this time he had lost his sense of reality. Walleran's hauteur was icy.
"I say, Philip used to have a mistress when he ran that little priory out in the forest. Then he became Prior of Kingsbridge and had to leave the woman behind. She didn't want the baby if she couldn't have the father, so she dumped the child on him. Philip, being a sentimental soul, felt obliged to take care of it, so he passed it off as a foundling."
William shook his head.
"Unbelievable. Anyone else? Yes. Philip? No."
Walleran persisted. "If the baby was abandoned, how can he prove where it came from?"
"He can't," William acknowledged.
He looked across the south transept to where Philip and Jonathan stood together, talking to the Bishop of Hereford.
"But they don't even look alike."
"You don't look like your mother," Walleran said. "Thank God."
"What good is all this?" William said. "What are you going to do about it?"
"Accuse him before an ecclesiastical court," Walleran replied. That made a difference. No one who knew Philip would credit Walleran's accusation for a moment, but a judge who was a stranger to Kingsbridge might find it more plausible. William saw reluctantly that Walleran's idea was not so stupid after all. As usual, Walleran was shrewder than William. Walleran was looking irritatingly smug, of course, but William was enthused by the prospect of bringing Philip down.
"By God," he said eagerly, "do you think it could be done?"
"It depends who the judge is, but I may be able to arrange something there."
I wonder.
William looked across the transept at Philip, triumphant and smiling, with his tall protégé beside him. The vast stained-glass windows threw an enchanted light over them, and they were like figures in a dream.
Fornication and nepotism, William said gleefully. My God!
If we can make it stick, Walleran said with relish, it will be the finish of that damned prior.
No reasonable judge could possibly find Philip guilty. The truth was that he had never had to try very hard to resist the temptation of fornication. He knew from hearing confession that some monks struggled desperately with fleshly lust, but he was not like that. There had been a time, at the age of about 18, when he had suffered impure dreams, but that phase had not lasted long. For most of his life, chastity had come easily to him. He had never performed the sexual act, and he was now probably too old for it. However, the church was taking the accusation very seriously. Philip was to be tried by an ecclesiastical court. An archdeacon from Canterbury would be present. Walleran had wanted the trial to be held at Shiring, but Philip had fought against that successfully, and it would now be held at Kingsbridge, which was, after all, the cathedral city. Now Philip was clearing his personal possessions out of the prior's house to make way for the archdeacon, who would be staying here. Philip knew he was innocent of fornication, and it followed logically that he could not be guilty of nepotism, for a man cannot favour his sons if he has none. Nevertheless, he searched his heart to see whether he had done wrong in promoting Jonathan. Just as impure thoughts were a kind of shadow of a graver sin, perhaps favouritism toward a loved orphan was the shadow of nepotism. Monks were supposed to forego the consolations of family life, yet Jonathan had been like a son to Philip. Philip had made Jonathan cellarer at a young age, and had now promoted him to sub-prior. Did I do that for my own pride and pleasure? He asked himself. Well, yes, he thought. He had taken enormous satisfaction from teaching Jonathan, watching him grow and seeing him learn how to manage priory affairs. But even if these things had not given Philip such intense pleasure, Jonathan would still have been the ablest young administrator in the priory. He was intelligent, devout, imaginative, and conscientious. Brought up in the monastery, he knew no other life, and he never hankered after freedom. Philip himself had been raised in an abbey. We monastery orphans make the best monks, he thought. He put a book into a satchel. Luke's Gospel, so wise. He had treated Jonathan like a son, but he had not committed any sins worth taking before an ecclesiastical court. The charge was absurd. Unfortunately, the mere accusation would be damaging. It diminished his moral authority. There would be people who would remember the charge and forget the verdict. Next time Philip stood up and said, "The commandment forbids a man to covet his neighbor's wife," some of the congregation would be thinking, "But you had your fun when you were young." Jonathan burst in, breathing hard. Philip frowned. The sub-prior ought not to burst into rooms, panting. Philip was about to launch into a homily on the dignity of monastic officers. Then Jonathan said, "Archdeacon Peter is here already." "All right, all right," Philip soothed. "I've just about finished, anyway." He handed Jonathan the satchel. "Take this to the dormitory and don't rush everywhere. A monastery is a place of peace and quiet." Jonathan accepted the satchel and the rebuke, but he said, "I don't like the look of the archdeacon." "I'm sure he'll be a just judge, and that's all we want," Philip said. The door opened again, and the archdeacon came in. He was a tall, rangy man of about Philip's age, with thinning grey hair, and a rather superior look on his face. He seemed vaguely familiar. Philip offered a handshake, saying, "I'm Prior Philip." "I know you," the archdeacon said sourly. "Don't you remember me?" The gravelly voice did it. Philip's heart sank. This was his oldest enemy. "Archdeacon Peter," he said grimly. "Peter of Wareham." "He was a troublemaker," Philip explained to Jonathan a few minutes later, when they had left the archdeacon to make himself comfortable in the prior's house.
He would complain that we didn't work hard enough, or we ate too well, or the services were too short. He said I was indulgent. He wanted to be prior himself, I'm sure. It would have been a disaster, of course. I made him almoner, so that he had to spend half his time away. I did it just to get rid of him. It was best for the priory and best for him, but I'm sure he still hates me for it, even after 35 years. He sighed. I heard, when you and I visited St. John in the Forest after the Great Famine, that Peter had gone to Canterbury, and now he's going to sit in judgment on me. They were in the cloisters. The weather was mild and the sun was warm. 50 boys in 3 different classes were learning to read and write in the North Walk, and the subdued murmur of their lessons floated across the quadrangle. Philip remembered when the school had consisted of 5 boys and a senile novice master. He thought of all he had done here, the building of the cathedral, the transformation of the impoverished, run-down priory into a wealthy, busy, influential institution, the enlargement of the town of Kingsbridge. In the church, more than 100 monks were singing Mass. From where he sat he could see the astonishingly beautiful stained-glass windows in the clerestory. At his back, off the east walk, was a stone-built library containing hundreds of books on theology, astronomy, ethics, mathematics, indeed every branch of knowledge. In the outside world, the priory's lands, managed with enlightened self-interest by monastic officers, fed not just the monks, but hundreds of farm workers. Was all that to be taken from him by a lie? Would the prosperous and God-fearing priory be handed over to someone else, a pawn of Bishop Walleran, such as the slimy Archdeacon Baldwin, or a self-righteous fool, such as Peter of Wareham, to be run down to penury and depravity as quickly as Philip had built it up? Would the vast flocks of sheep shrink to a handful of scrawny ewes, the farms return to weed-grown inefficiency, the library become dusty with disuse, the beautiful cathedral sink into damp and disrepair? God helped me to achieve so much, he thought. I can't believe he intended it to come to nothing. Jonathan said, all the same, Archdeacon Peter can't possibly find you guilty. I think he will, Philip said heavily. In all conscience, how can he? I think he's been nursing a grievance against me all his life, and this is his chance to prove that I was the sinner, and he was the righteous man all along. Somehow Walleran found out about that and made sure Peter was appointed to judge this case. But there's no proof. He doesn't need proof. He'll hear the accusation and the defense, then he'll pray for guidance, and he'll announce his verdict. God may guide him aright. Peter won't listen to God. He's never been a listener. What will happen? I'll be deposed, Philip said grimly. They may let me continue here as an ordinary monk to do penance for my sin, but it's not likely. More probably they will expel me from the order, to prevent my having any further influence here. What would happen then? There would have to be an election, of course. Unfortunately, royal politics enter into the picture now. King Henry is in dispute with the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Becket, and Archbishop Thomas is in exile in France. Half his archdeacons are with him. The other half, the ones who stayed behind, have sided with the king against their archbishop. Peter obviously belongs to that crowd. Bishop Walleran has also taken the king's side. Walleran will recommend his choice of prior, backed by the Canterbury archdeacons and the king. It will be hard for the monks here to oppose him. Who do you think it might be? Walleran has someone in mind, rest assured. It could be Archdeacon Baldwin. It might even be Peter of Wareham. We must do something to prevent this, Jonathan said. Philip nodded. But everything is against us. There's nothing we can do to alter the political situation. The only possibility... What? Jonathan said impatiently. The case seemed so hopeless that Philip felt there was no point in toying with desperate ideas. It would excite Jonathan's optimism only to disappoint him. Nothing, Philip said. What were you going to say? Philip was still working it out. If there was a way to prove my innocence beyond doubt, it would be impossible for Peter to find me guilty. But what would count as proof? Exactly. You can't prove a negative. We would have to find your real father.
Jonathan was instantly enthusiastic.
Yes, that's it. That's what we'll do. Slow down, Philip said. I tried at the time. It's not likely to be any easier so many years later.
Jonathan was not to be discouraged.
Were there no clues at all to where I might have come from?
Nothing, I'm afraid. Philip was now worried that he had raised hopes in Jonathan which could not be fulfilled. Although the boy had no memories of his parents, the fact that they had abandoned him had always troubled him. Now he thought he might solve the mystery and find some explanation which proved they had loved him really. Philip felt sure this could only lead to frustration.
"Did you question people living nearby?" Jonathan said.
"There was nobody living nearby. That cell is deep in the forest. Your parents probably came from miles away, Winchester perhaps. I've been all over this ground already."
Jonathan persisted.
"You didn't see any travellers in the forest around that time?"
"No."
Philip frowned. Was that true? A stray thought tugged at his memory. The day the baby was found, Philip had left the priory to go to the bishop's palace, and on his way he had spoken to some people. Suddenly it came back to him.
"Well, yes, as a matter of fact, Tom Builder and his family were passing through."
Jonathan was astonished.
"You never told me that.
It never seemed important."
"It still doesn't. I met them a day or two later. I questioned them, and they said they hadn't seen anyone who might have been the mother or father of an abandoned baby."
Jonathan was crestfallen. Philip was afraid this whole line of inquiry was going to prove doubly disappointing to him. He would not find out about his parents, and he would fail to prove Philip's innocence. But there was no stopping him now.
"What were they doing in the forest anyway?"
he persisted. "Tom was on his way to the bishop's palace. He was looking for work. That's how they ended up here."
"I want to question them again."
"Well, Tom and Alfred are dead. Ellen is living in the forest, and only God knows when she will reappear. But you could talk to Jack or Martha."
"It's worth a try."
Perhaps Jonathan was right. He had the energy of youth. Philip had been pessimistic and discouraging.
"Go ahead," he said to Jonathan.
"I'm getting old and tired. Otherwise I would have thought of it myself. Talk to Jack. It's a slender thread to hang on to, but it's our only hope."
The design of the window had been drawn, full size and painted, on a huge wooden table which had been washed with ale to prevent the colours from running. The drawing showed the tree of Jesse, a genealogy of Christ in picture form. Sally picked up a small piece of thick ruby-coloured glass and placed it on the design over the body of one of the kings of Israel. Jack was not sure which king. He had never been able to remember the convoluted symbolism of theological pictures. Sally dipped a fine brush in a bowl of chalk ground up in water, and painted the shape of the body onto the glass, shoulders, arms, and the skirt of the robe. In the fire on the ground beside her table was an iron rod with a wooden handle. She took the rod out of the fire, and then, quickly but carefully, she ran the red-hot end of the rod around the outline she had painted. The glass cracked neatly along the line. Her apprentice picked up the piece of glass and began to smooth its edges with a grozing iron. Jack loved to watch his daughter work. She was quick and precise, her movements economical. As a little girl, she had been fascinated by the work of the glaziers Jack had brought over from Paris, and she always said that was what she wanted to do when she grew up. She had stuck by that choice. When people came to Kingsbridge Cathedral for the first time, they were more struck by Sally's glass than her father's architecture, Jack thought ruefully. The apprentice handed the smoothed glass to her, and she began to paint the folds of the robe onto the surface, using a paint made of iron ore, urine, and gum arabic for adhesion. The flat glass suddenly began to look like soft, carelessly draped cloth. She was very skillful. She finished it quickly, then put the painted glass alongside several others in an iron pan, the bottom of which was covered with lime. When the pan was full, it would go into an oven. The heat would fuse the paint to the glass. She looked up at Jack, gave him a brief, dazzling smile, then picked up another piece of glass.
He moved away. He could watch her all day, but he had work to do. He was, as Eleanor would say, daft about his daughter. When he looked at her, it was often with a kind of amazement that he was responsible for the existence of this clever, independent, mature young woman. He was thrilled that she was such a good craftswoman. Ironically, he had always pressured Tommy to be a builder. He had actually forced the boy to work on the site for a couple of years. But Tommy was interested in farming, horsemanship, hunting, and swordplay, all the things that left Jack cold. In the end, Jack had conceded defeat. Tommy had served as a squire to one of the local lords, and had eventually been knighted. Aliena had granted him a small estate of 5 villages, and Sally had turned out to be the talented one. Tommy was married now to a younger daughter of the Earl of Bedford, and they had 3 children. Jack was a grandfather, but Sally was still single at the age of 25. There was a lot of her grandmother Ellen in her. She was aggressively self-reliant. Jack walked around to the west end of the cathedral and looked up at the twin towers. They were almost complete, and a huge bronze bell was on its way here from the foundry in London. There was not much for Jack to do nowadays. Where he had once controlled an army of muscular stone-cutters and carpenters, laying rows of square stones and building scaffolding, he now had a handful of carvers and painters doing precise and painstaking work on a small scale, making statues for niches, building ornamental pinnacles, and gilding the wings of stone angels. There was not much to design apart from the occasional new building for the priory, a library, a chapter house, more accommodation for pilgrims, new laundry and dairy buildings. In between petty jobs, Jack was doing some stone carving himself, for the first time in many years. He was impatient to pull down Tom Builder's old chancel and put up a new east end to his own design. But Prior Philip wanted to enjoy the finished church for a year before beginning another building campaign. Philip was feeling his age. Jack was afraid the old boy might not live to see the chancel rebuilt. However, the work would be continued after Philip's death, Jack thought, as he saw the enormously tall figure of Brother Jonathan striding toward him from the direction of the kitchen courtyard. Jonathan would make a good prior, perhaps even as good as Philip himself. Jack was glad the succession was assured. It enabled him to plan for the future. "I'm worried about this ecclesiastical court, Jack," said Jonathan without preamble. Jack said, "I thought that was all a big fuss about nothing." "So did I. But the archdeacon turns out to be an old enemy of Prior Philip's." "Hell. But even so, surely he can't find him guilty. He can do anything he wants." Jack shook his head in disgust. He sometimes wondered how men such as Jonathan could continue to believe in the church when it was so shamelessly corrupt. "What are you going to do? The only way we can prove his innocence is to find out who my parents were. It's a bit late for that. It's our only hope." Jack was somewhat shaken. They were quite desperate. "Where are you going to start?" "With you. You were in the area of St. John in the Forest at the time I was born." "Was I?" Jack did not see what Jonathan was getting at. "I lived there until I was 11, and I must be about 11 years older than you."
"Father Philip says he met you, with your mother and Tom Builder and Tom's children, the day after I was found."
"I remember that. We ate all Philip's food. We were starving."
"Think hard. Did you see anyone with a baby or a young woman who might have been pregnant anywhere near that area?"
"Wait a minute."
Jack was puzzled.
"Are you telling me that you were found near St. John in the Forest?"
"Yes. Didn't you know that?"
Jack could hardly believe his ears.
"No, I didn't know that," he said slowly. His mind was reeling with the implications of the revelation. "When we arrived in Kingsbridge, you were already here, and I naturally assumed you had been found in the forest near here." He suddenly felt the need to sit down. There was a pile of building rubble nearby, and he lowered himself onto it. Jonathan said impatiently, "Well, anyway, did you see anyone in the forest?"
"Oh, yes," Jack said. "I don't know how to tell you this, Jonathan."
Jonathan paled. "You know something about this, don't you? What did you see?"
"I saw you, Jonathan. That's what I saw."
Jonathan's mouth dropped open.
What? How?
It was dawn. I was on a duck hunting expedition. I heard a cry. I found a newborn baby wrapped in a cut-up old cloak lying beside the embers of a dying fire. Jonathan stared at him. Anything else? Jack nodded slowly. The baby was lying on a new grave. Jonathan swallowed. My mother. Jack nodded. Jonathan began to weep, but he kept asking questions. What did you do? I fetched my mother, but while we were returning to the spot, we saw a priest riding a palfrey carrying the baby.
Francis,
Jonathan said in a choked voice.
What?
He swallowed hard.
I was found by Father Philip's brother, Francis, the priest.
What was he doing there?
He was on his way to see Philip at St. John in the Forest. That's where he took me.
My God. Jack stared at the tall monk with tears streaming down his cheeks. You haven't heard it all yet, Jonathan, he thought. Jonathan said, Did you see anyone who might have been my father?
Yes,
Jack said solemnly. I know who he was.
Tell me,
Jonathan whispered. Tom Builder.
Tom Builder?
Jonathan sat down heavily on the ground.
Tom Builder was my father.
Yes. Jack shook his head in wonderment. Now I know who you remind me of. You and he are the tallest people I ever met.
He was always good to me when I was a child,
Jonathan said in a dazed tone.
He used to play with me. He was fond of me. I saw as much of him as I did of Prior Philip.
His tears flowed freely.
That was my father. My father.
He looked up at Jack.
Why did he abandon me?
They thought you were going to die anyway. They had no milk to give you. They were starving themselves, I know. They were miles from anywhere. They didn't know the priory was nearby. They had no food except turnips, and turnips would have killed you.
They did love me, after all.
Jack saw the scene as if it were yesterday. The dying fire, the freshly turned earth of the new grave, and the tiny pink baby kicking its arms and legs inside the old grey cloak. That little scrap of humanity had grown into the tall man who sat weeping on the ground in front of him. Oh, yes. They loved you.
How come nobody ever spoke of it?
Tom was ashamed, of course, Jack said. My mother must have known that, and we children sensed it, I suppose. Anyway, it was an unmentionable topic, and we never connected that baby with you, of course.
Tom must have made the connection,
Jonathan said.
Yes. I wonder why he never took me back.
My mother left him quite soon after we came here, Jack said. He smiled ruefully. She was hard to please, like Sally. Anyway, that meant Tom would have had to hire a nursemaid to look after you, so I suppose he thought, why not leave the baby at the monastery? You were well cared for there. Jonathan nodded. By dear old Johnny Eightpence, God rest his soul. Tom probably spent more time with you that way. You were running around the priory close all day and every day, and he was working there. If he'd taken you away from the priory and left you at home with a nursemaid, he'd actually have seen less of you. And I imagine as the years went by and you grew up as the priory orphan, and seemed happy that way, it felt more and more natural to leave you there. People often give a child to God anyway.
All these years I've wondered about my parents, Jonathan said.
Jack's heart ached for him.
I've tried to imagine what they were like. Asked God to let me meet them, wondered whether they loved me, questioned why they left me. Now I know that my mother died giving birth to me and my father was close to me all the rest of his life.
He smiled through his tears.
I can't tell you how happy I am.
Jack felt close to tears himself. To cover his embarrassment, he said, You look like Tom.
Do I?
Jonathan was pleased. Don't you remember how tall he was?
All adults were tall then.
He had good features like you, well carved. If ever you'd grown a beard, people would have guessed.
I remember the day he died,
Jonathan said. He took me around the fair. We watched the bear baiting. Then I climbed the wall of the chancel. I was too frightened to come down, so he had to come up and carry me down. Then he saw William's men coming. He put me in the cloisters. That was the last time I saw him alive.
I remember that, Jack said. I watched him climb down with you in his arms.
He made sure I was safe, Jonathan said wonderingly.
Then he took care of the others, Jack said.
He really loved me.
Jack was struck by a thought. This will make a difference to Philip's trial, won't it?
I'd forgotten that, Jonathan said. Yes, it will. My goodness.
Have we got irrefutable proof? Jack wondered. I saw the baby and the priest, but I never actually saw the baby delivered to the little priory.
Francis did, but Francis is Philip's brother, so his evidence is tainted.
My mother and Tom went off together that morning, Jack said, straining his memory. They said they were going to look for the priest. I bet they went to the priory to make sure the baby was all right.
If you would say so in court, that would really sew it up, Jonathan said eagerly.
Philip thinks she's a witch, Jack pointed out. Would he let her testify?
We could spring it on him, but she hates him too.
Will she testify?
I don't know, said Jack.
Let's ask her.
Fornication and nepotism, Jack's mother cried. Philip!
She started to laugh.
It's too absurd.
Mother, this is serious, Jack said.
Philip couldn't fornicate if you put him in a battle with three whores, she said.
He wouldn't know what to do.
Jonathan was looking embarrassed. Prior Philip is in real trouble, even if the charge is absurd, he said.
And why would I help Philip, she said. He's caused me nothing but heartache.
Jack had been afraid of this. His mother had never forgiven Philip for splitting her and Tom.
Philip did the same to me as he did to you. If I can forgive him, you can.
I'm not the forgiving type, she said.
Don't do it for Philip, then. Do it for me. I want to continue building at Kingsbridge.
Why? The church is finished. I'd like to pull down Tom's chancel and rebuild it in the new style.
Oh, for God's sake!
Mother, Philip is a good prior, and when he goes, Jonathan will take over. If you come to Kingsbridge and tell the truth at the trial.
I hate courts, she said. No good ever comes out of them.
It was maddening. She held the key to Philip's trial. She could ensure that he was cleared. But she was a stubborn old woman. Jack was seriously afraid he would not be able to talk her into it. He decided to try stinging her into consenting. I suppose it's a long way to travel for someone of your age, he said slyly. How old are you now? 68?
62, and don't try to provoke me, she snapped. I'm fitter than you, my boy.
It could be true, Jack thought. Her hair was white as snow, and her face was deeply lined. But her startling golden eyes saw just as much as ever they had. As soon as she looked at Jonathan, she had known who he was, and she had said, Well, I've no need to ask why you're here. You found out where you come from, have you? By God, you're as tall as your father and nearly as broad. She was also as independent and self-willed as ever.
Sally is like you, Jack said.
She was pleased.
Is she?
She smiled.
In what way?
In her mulish obstinacy.
Huh.
Mother looked cross.
She'll be all right, then.
Jack decided he might as well beg.
Mother, please come to Kingsbridge with us and tell the truth.
I don't know, she said.
Jonathan said, I have something else to ask you.
Jack wondered what was coming. He was afraid Jonathan might say something to antagonize his mother. It was easily done, especially by clergymen. He held his breath.
Jonathan said, Could you show me where my mother is buried?
Jack let his breath out silently. There was nothing wrong with that. Indeed, Jonathan could hardly have thought of anything more likely to soften her. She dropped her scornful manner immediately.
Of course I'll show you, she said. I'm pretty sure I could find it.
Jack was reluctant to spend the time. The trial would start in the morning, and they had a long way to go. But he sensed that he should let fate take its course.
Mother said to Jonathan, Do you want to go there now?
Yes, please, if it's possible.
All right.
She stood up. She picked up a short cape of rabbit fur and slung it across her shoulders. Jack was about to tell her she would be too warm in that, but he held back. Old people always felt colder. They left the cave with its smell of stored apples and wood smoke, and pushed through the concealing vegetation around its mouth to emerge into the spring sunshine. Mother set off without hesitation. Jack and Jonathan untied their horses and followed. They had to lead their mounts, for the terrain was too overgrown for riding. Jack noticed that his mother walked more slowly than she used to. She was not as fit as she pretended. Jack could not have found the site on his own. There had been a time when he could find his way around this forest as easily as he could now move around Kingsbridge. But one clearing looked very much like another to him these days, just as the houses of Kingsbridge would all look the same to a stranger. Mother followed a chain of animal trails through the dense woodland. Now and again Jack would recognize a landmark associated with some childhood memory, an enormous old oak where he had once taken refuge from a wild boar, a rabbit warren that had provided many a dinner, a trout stream where, it seemed in retrospect, he had been able to catch fat fish in no time. For a while he would know where he was, then he would be lost again. It was amazing to think he had once felt totally at home in what was now an alien place, its brooks and thickets as meaningless to him as his voussoirs and templets were to peasants. If he had ever wondered in those days how his life would turn out, his best guess would have been nowhere near the truth. They walked several miles. It was a warm spring day, and Jack found himself sweating, but Mother kept the rabbit fur on. Toward mid-afternoon she came to a halt in a shady clearing. Jack noticed she was breathing hard and looked a little grey. It was definitely time she left the forest and came to live with him and Aliena. He resolved that he would make a big effort to persuade her. "Are you all right?" he said. "Of course I'm all right," she snapped. "We're there." Jack looked around. He did not recognize it. Jonathan said, "Is this it?" "Yes," Mother said. Jack said, "Where's the road?" "Over there." When Jack had oriented himself with the road, the clearing began to look familiar, and he was flooded with a powerful sense of the past. There was the big horse chestnut tree. It had been bare of leaves then, and there had been conkers all over the forest floor. But now the tree was in blossom, with big white flowers like candles all over it. The blossom had started to fall already, and every few moments a cloud of petals drifted down. "Martha told me what had happened," Jack said. "They stopped here because your mother could go no farther. Tom made a fire and boiled some turnips for supper. There was no meat. Your mother gave birth to you, right here on the ground. You were perfectly healthy, but something went wrong and she died." There was a slight rise in the ground a few feet from the base of the tree. "Look," Jack said. "See the mound?" Jonathan nodded, his face taut with suppressed emotion. "That's the grave." As Jack spoke, a drift of blossom fell from the tree and settled over the mound like a carpet of petals. Jonathan knelt beside the grave and began to pray. Jack stood silent. He remembered when he had discovered his relatives in Cherbourg. It had been a devastating experience. What Jonathan was going through must be even more intense. Eventually, Jonathan stood up. "When I'm prior," he said solemnly, "I'm going to build a little monastery, just here, with a chapel and a hostel, so that in future no traveller on this stretch of road will ever have to spend a cold winter's night sleeping in the open air. I'll dedicate the hostel to the memory of my mother." He looked at Jack. "I don't suppose you ever knew her name, did you?"
"It was Agnes," Ellen said softly. "Your mother's name was Agnes."
Bishop Walleran made a persuasive case. He began by telling the court about Philip's precocious development, cellarer of his monastery when he was only 21, prior of the cell of St. John in the Forest at 23, prior of Kingsbridge at the remarkably young age of 28. He constantly emphasized Philip's youth and managed to suggest there was something arrogant about anyone who accepted responsibility early. Then he described St. John in the Forest, its remoteness and isolation, and spoke of the freedom and independence of whoever was its prior.
Who can be surprised, he said, that after 5 years, as virtually his own master, with only the lightest and most distant kind of supervision, this inexperienced, warm-blooded young man had a child. It sounded almost inevitable. Walleran was infuriatingly credible. Philip wanted to strangle him. Walleran went on to say how Philip had brought Jonathan and Johnny Eightpence with him when he came to Kingsbridge. The monks had been startled, Walleran said, when their new prior arrived with a baby and a nurse. That was true. For a moment Philip forgot his tension and had to suppress a nostalgic smile. Philip had played with Jonathan as a youngster, taught him lessons, and later made the lad his personal assistant, Walleran went on, just as any man would do with his own son, except that monks were not supposed to have sons. Jonathan was precocious, just like Philip, Walleran said. When Cuthbert Whitehead died, Philip made Jonathan cellarer, even though Jonathan was only 21. Was there really no one else who could be cellarer in this monastery of more than 100 monks? No one but a boy of 21? Or was Philip giving preference to his own flesh and blood? When Milius went off to be prior at Glastonbury, Philip made Jonathan treasurer. He is 34 years old. Is he the wisest and most devout of all the monks here? Or is he simply Philip's favourite? Philip looked around at the court. It was being held in the south transept of Kingsbridge Cathedral. Archdeacon Peter sat on a large, ornately carved chair like a throne. All of Walleran's staff were present, as were most of the monks of Kingsbridge. There would be little work done in the monastery while the prior was on trial. Every important churchman in the county was here, even some of the humble parish priests. There were also representatives from neighbouring dioceses. The entire ecclesiastical community of southern England was waiting for the verdict of this court. They were not very interested in Philip's virtue or lack of it, of course. They were following the final trial of strength between Prior Philip and Bishop Walleran. When Walleran sat down, Philip took the oath, then began to tell the story of that winter morning so long ago. He started with the upset caused by Peter of Wareham. He wanted everyone to know that Peter was prejudiced against him. Then he called Francis to tell how the baby was found. Jonathan had gone off, leaving a message to say that he was on the track of new information about his parentage. Jack had disappeared too, from which Philip had concluded that the trip had something to do with Jack's mother, the witch, Ellen, and that Jonathan had been afraid that if he stayed to explain, Philip would have forbidden the journey. They had been due back this morning, but had not yet arrived. Philip did not think Ellen would have anything to add to the story Francis was telling. When Francis had done, Philip began to speak. "That baby was not mine," he said simply. "I swear it was not mine. In peril of my immortal soul, I swear it. I have never had carnal knowledge of a woman, and I remain to this day in that state of chastity commended to us by the Apostle Paul. So why, the Lord Bishop asks, did I treat the babe as if it were my own?" He looked around at the listeners. He had decided that his only chance was to tell the truth, and hope that God would speak loud enough to overcome Peter's spiritual deafness. "When I was 6 years old, my father and mother died. They were killed by soldiers of the old King Henry in Wales. My brother and I were saved by the abbot of a nearby monastery, and from that day onward we were cared for by monks. I was a monastery orphan. I know what it's like. I understand how the orphan yearns for a mother's touch, even though he loves the brothers who care for him. I knew that Jonathan would feel abnormal, peculiar, illegitimate. I have felt that feeling of isolation, the sense that I am different from everyone else because they all have a father and a mother and I do not. Like him, I have felt ashamed of myself for being a burden on the charity of others, have wondered what was wrong with me,
that I should have been deprived of what others took for granted. I knew that he would dream in the night of the warm, fragrant bosom and soft voice of a mother he never knew, someone who loved him utterly and completely.
Archdeacon Peter's face was like stone. He was the worst kind of Christian, Philip realized. He embraced all of the negatives, enforced every prescription, insisted on all forms of denial, and demanded strict punishment for every offense. Yet he ignored all the compassion of Christianity, denied its mercy, flagrantly disobeyed its ethic of love, and openly flouted the gentle laws of Jesus. That's what the Pharisees were like, Philip thought. No wonder the Lord preferred to eat with publicans and sinners. He went on, although he understood, with a sinking heart, that nothing he could say would penetrate the armor of Peter's righteousness. Nobody could care for that boy as I could, unless it were his own parents, and those we could never find. What clearer indication of God's will? He tailed off. Jonathan had just come into the church with Jack, and between them was the witch, Jack's mother. She had aged. Her hair was snow-white, and her face was deeply lined. But she walked in like a queen, her head held high, her strange golden eyes blazing with defiance. Philip was too surprised to protest. The court was silent as she entered the transept and stood facing Archdeacon Peter. She spoke in a voice that rang like a trumpet and echoed from the clerestory of her son's church. I swear by all that is holy that Jonathan is the son of Tom Builder, my dead husband, and his first wife. There was an astonished clamor from the crowd of clergy. For a while nobody could be heard. Philip was completely bowled over. He stared open-mouthed at Ellen. Tom Builder? Jonathan was the son of Tom Builder? When he looked at Jonathan, he knew immediately that it was true. They were alike not just in their height, but facially. If Jonathan had had a beard, it would have been obvious. His first reaction was a sense of loss. Until now he had been the nearest Jonathan had to a father. But Tom was Jonathan's real father, and although Tom was dead, the discovery changed everything. Philip could no longer secretly think of himself as a father. Jonathan would no longer feel like his son. Jonathan was Tom's son now. Philip had lost him. Philip sat down heavily. When the crowd began to quiet down, Ellen told the story of Jack hearing a cry and finding a newborn baby. Philip listened, dazed, as she told how she and Tom had hidden in the bushes, watching, as Philip and the monks came back from their morning's work to find Francis waiting for them with a newborn baby, and Johnny Eightpence trying to feed it with a rag dipped into a bucket of goat's milk. Philip remembered very clearly how interested the young Tom had been a day or so later when they had met by accident and Philip had told him about the abandoned baby. Philip had assumed his interest was that of any compassionate man in a touching story, but in fact Tom had been learning the fate of his own child. Then Philip recalled how fond Tom had been of Jonathan in later years, as the baby turned into a toddler and then a mischievous boy. Nobody had remarked on it. The whole monastery had treated Jonathan as a pet in those days, and Tom spends all his time in the priory close, so his behavior was completely unremarkable. But now, in retrospect, Philip could see that the attention Tom paid to Jonathan was special. As Ellen sat down, Philip realized that he had been proved innocent. Ellen's revelations had been so devastating that he had almost forgotten he was on trial. Her story of childbirth and death, desperation and hope, ancient secrets and enduring love, made the question of Philip's chastity seem trivial. It was not trivial, of course. The future of the priory hung on it. And Ellen had now answered the question so dramatically that it seemed impossible the trial should continue. Even Peter of Wareham can't find me guilty after evidence like this, Philip thought. Walleran had lost again. Walleran was not quite ready to concede defeat, however. He pointed an accusing finger at Ellen.
You say Tom Builder told you that the baby brought to the cell was his?
Yes, Ellen said warily.
But the other two people who might have been able to confirm this, the children, Alfred and Martha,